Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wouldn't it be great if one of the big banks at the heart of the subprime mess just took it on the chin, stepped up and said, "You know what? We shouldn't have sold all those lousy bonds and securities, and we're sorry. We're so sorry that we're going to buy them all back and make things right." Citigroup did that today, once it got some encouragement from state regulators. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 7th of August. Good to have you here. And I'm going to have to ask you to pay extra special attention today as we start out on the topic of illiquid auction rate securities. Trust me when I say we're doing you a favor by sparing you the exact definition of what they are. But the market for them froze up almost without notice earlier this year. When it did, tens of thousands of investors got burned. Giant corporations and small businesses, along with retirees and plain old folk hoping to make a decent return on their money. Today, the country's biggest bank and the biggest purveyor of auction rate securities agreed to make good on $7 billion worth of those seemingly worthless bonds. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has the details.
Citigroup is the first bank to reach a major settlement with federal and state authorities. They've accused several banks of fraudulently misleading investors about the risk they were buying into. Citi has agreed to buy back the frozen bonds at their full face value. Retail customers, charities, and small or mid-sized businesses should get their money within the next 3 months. New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo announced the settlement today.
This resolution will make a big difference for a lot of people. Over 40,000 people nationwide, 40,000. We'll have securities redeemed. The total value of the securities is about $7 billion.
The deal doesn't cover other banks currently being investigated and or facing lawsuits in several states. In Frederick, Maryland, investor John Dickerson prefers not to say how much money his family still has tied up in accounts sold by Merrill Lynch. He says they were told the cash would be available whenever it was needed.
It was just absolutely pushed as this is just the easiest, safest, greatest way to make a little extra on your money, and that there would be no problem getting in or out at any time.
That was supposed to be possible because frequent auctions are held to trade them on the open market. Dickerson says the problem is credit worries seized up the market soon after the start of the year, and there still aren't any bidders.
We go to auction every Tuesday and Thursday, and every Tuesday and Thursday the auctions fail.
Dickerson is hopeful today's settlement will put pressure on Citigroup's rivals to do what Andrew Cuomo calls the right thing.
The people are getting their money back, and that's what it's all about.
But this $7 billion settlement is just part of an auction rate securities market worth $330 billion before it melted down in February. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Bob mentioned the Citigroup settlement's only part of a huge auction rate market. That, of course, means there's plenty of blame to go around. Bank of America announced this afternoon that it's on the receiving end of state and federal subpoenas about its auction rate dealings, too. In the heated battle over fuel versus food, you can chalk one up for fuel. Today, the Environmental Protection Agency told Texas Governor Rick Perry that it's not going to let him cut the amount of ethanol Texas has to put in its gasoline. The energy bill Congress passed in December said states have to blend 9 billion gallons of ethanol into their fuel supplies this year. It takes more than 20 pounds of corn to make a gallon of ethanol, so you can see where I'm going. Texas and other states blame the ethanol requirement for sky-high corn and food prices. Marketplace's Janet Babin has more now from North Carolina Public Radio.
The Environmental Protection Agency said any decision it made on ethanol production now wouldn't bring down prices in Texas. John Doggett with the National Corn Growers Association agrees with the EPA decision.
Many things have influenced the price of corn. not least of which is ethanol production. But to lay all of the increase at the foot of the ethanol industry is wrong, and that was proved today.
How about those corn prices? They got close to $8 a bushel on the futures market a few months ago and are climbing again on today's announcement. Those who oppose today's decision, though, say that for every corn farmer reaping a profit, there's a family who can't pay the grocery bill. Scott Faber with the Grocery Manufacturers Association says more than a third of the corn crop now goes to fuel, and that increases the cost of food.
We're a high-volume, low-margin industry. So as the cost of these basic ingredients go up, we're going to have to pass some of those costs along to consumers.
Faber says food prices have already risen around 6%, and critics say ethanol hasn't lived up to its promise. It was supposed to cut pollution and reduce demand for oil. Frank O'Donnell's with Clean Air Watch. It's not often he agrees with Texas, but he does today. He says the EPA got it wrong.
We are actually seeing more air pollution this summer than last. Now, maybe it's a coincidence, maybe not, but we've got more ethanol and we've got more smog.
Groups against today's decision plan to lobby Congress to ease the ethanol mandate. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
There is nothing like grabbing a nice cold beer out of a tub of ice on a hot summer afternoon. But there is a chance you've been paying too much to cool your suds. Believe it or not, those bags you buy at the convenience store are worth close to $2 billion a year. And there are new details coming to light in a federal ICE price-fixing investigation. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
When you buy a bag of ice at your local supermarket, it likely comes from one of three companies: Arctic Glacier, Home City Ice, or Ready Ice. Here I am at the Food Emporium in Manhattan, a grocery store. And here we are, sure enough, Arctic Glacier from Manitoba, Canada. Dozens of lawsuits accuse all three companies of agreeing to divvy up the ice market and stay out of each other's territories. Only one has been charged with criminal wrongdoing. Home City Ice of Cincinnati pleaded guilty to conspiracy charges. Attorney Barry Barnett represents stores that want their money back.
The purpose of an agreement like that is to make more money, because it limits the output that's available for people. The demand stays the same, so the price goes up.
One man helping authorities investigate is now speaking out. Former Arctic Glacier employee Martin McNulty says when he objected to the conspiracy, he was essentially blackballed.
I was told pretty quickly that there's an allocation relationship between Arctic Glacier as well as Home City and Ready Ice, and that if I didn't want to be a part of it, there's really nowhere else to go, that I would not be hired by those other ice companies.
McNulty is now suing Arctic Glacier for back pay and other damages. The company didn't return calls today, but has said it's cooperating with authorities. The Justice Department would only say its investigation is ongoing. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
New worries about the credit crunch didn't do Wall Street any favors. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the advantage of hindsight, it's easy to say some of the startups in the dot-com boom obviously weren't long for this world. Pets.com, anybody? But what if investors could have predicted that before investing? And what if back in 1998, you could have known that Google would one day rule the planet? A company called YouNoodle says its new web application can help you do that. Marketplace's Rico Galliano has more.
Back in 2007, YouNoodle CEO Bob Goodson noticed something disturbing. $67 billion was flowing into tech startups based solely on the calculations of human beings.
People meeting up in person and making decisions without the use of computers, which is really quite surprising because other industries that deal with risk have made use of computers.
Like the insurance industry, for instance. So today, YouNoodle launched its startup predictor for the tech industry. Users fill out a questionnaire about a startup, then an algorithm spits out what the company's value will be 3 years from now. The program evaluates four main things.
Factors regarding the team members, the advisors, financial factors, and concept.
But computers are only really good at the first two, looking at the background of workers and managers, and gauging how they'll help or hurt a company. So, unlike the by-the-numbers insurance biz, Goodman doesn't expect computer predictions to replace the tech industry's human heart.
in something like startup investment, there is a very personal element. Humans, for a long time, are going to be much better analyzing concepts, products.
Great. Then I have to ask you, I have an idea for a website that would be called Get Back to Work. That would just be a splash screen with the words Get Back to Work on it. That employers could email to employees who goof off on the internet too much, and we could sell, you know, ad time to temp agencies. What is your prediction on that?
I don't know if anyone would click the link.
Well, we'll see what the startup predictor has to say. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace, and I'll get back to you on that.
The Olympics aren't supposed to be about politics, but of course they are. They're not supposed to be about money either, but of course they are. Companies and countries spend millions or more on the games, some of which eventually trickles down to the athletes. American swimmers Michael Phelps and Dara Torres have already made their deals. We've got Diana Nyad here to talk about the rest of the pack. Hey, Diana.
Hi, Guy.
So listen, after Michael Phelps and Dara Torres, who do you like for sponsorship deals coming out of these games?
Well, there are a number of people, which we wouldn't have said in other Olympics. BMX bike racing, for instance, first time ever in the Olympic Games. Now, agreed, that event will not pull a huge number in terms of television audience, but because the X Games and those young people who, as a general rule, don't watch much of the Olympics, will have BMX to watch. There's a guy named Donnie Robinson, who is a favorite in the BMX racing. If he wins a gold in his niche sport, he's going to cash in pretty well.
Taekwondo, another niche sport, right?
It's fairly new, and there's a Latino family, the Lopez family, two brothers and a sister, but Steven particularly, best fighter in his weight category, Minute Maid, AT&T, Coca-Cola. They like this guy because he represents the Latino population, growing at three times the average population in this country. If he takes that gold, if he stands on that metal platform with the Star Spangled Banner playing, believe me, there are going to be some very sweet contracts for Steven Lopez at the end of the games.
Let me ask you about another swimmer, Cullen Jones, who's gotten a decent amount of press and some sponsorships too.
Cullen Jones has a number of sponsorships. Nike signed him to a 7-year deal for close to $2 million, which for a basketball player isn't much. For a swimmer is huge. He happens to be African-American. There are a number of companies, Bank of America is one of his sponsors, who would love to be in that African-American community more. And they're looking to Cullen Jones not to be the big, you know, multiple gold medal winner, because he won't. But he's the third African-American in all of history to make a swimming team for the United States. And so, you know, just him being there and representing the country well and maybe meddling in a relay could bring in a lot of money for this young man.
What's your guess as to shelf life for some of these sort of not mega star athletes coming out of these games?
Sponsors and agents feel it's 6 months. You know, Natalie Coughlin, for instance, a good example. When she came back from Athens, she was a big star in Athens. She said 3 months. She said 3 months, the phone stopped ringing, people stopped recognizing her on the street. That's about how long our attention span is these days.
I have to ask you the what-if question about Michael Phelps and Dara Torres. What happens to their marketability, I guess, if Michael Phelps only, I say with quotation marks, comes home with 6 golds and Dara doesn't get the gold in her sprint?
Well, let's start with Phelps. If he doesn't beat Mark Spitz's seven record of golds, we will say, oh, what a disappointment. Oh, he was touted as being the greatest ever. But in China, his agent did a very smart thing. Last year, he had Phelps in 2007 tour all of China. And he was popular over there, signed a big 7-figure deal with an electronics company. And the Chinese will love him at the end of this games, even with only 6 gold, if that's what he takes. Dara Torres, in my opinion, it doesn't matter where she finishes. The woman's 41. Yeah. We love her, and she can come home with no medal at all. She's still going to be bankable.
Diana Nyad in the Business of Sports. Thanks, Diana.
You're so welcome.
John McCain rolled out a new television ad this week, one that makes it look like the Republican candidate's trying to put a little bit of distance between his campaign and some more traditional GOP constituencies.
Only McCain has taken on big tobacco, drug companies, fought corruption in both parties.
Commentator and economist James Galbraith says he's seen a lot of repositioning among conservatives lately.
Years ago, I realized that the free market supply-side crowd, true conservatives who had ridden high with Reagan, dislike Bush as much as I do. I speak of the hard money, low tax, Wall Street Journal deregulate and privatize team, the nemeses of my youth, people like Bruce Bartlett, Paul Craig Roberts, the late Jude Winiski. Suddenly, we were on the same side. Had I gone crazy, or had they gone sane? Whether it was right or wrong, Reaganomics had a logic. Each policy would aim at one problem. Tight money would cure inflation. Low taxes would stimulate saving and work effort. Small government would crowd in investment. Free trade would make us efficient. Smart people believed this, and they had the authority of respected economists like Milton Friedman and Friedrich von Hayek to back them up. But now those ideas are dead, buried, abandoned. Deregulation brought us miseries in finance, transport, energy, and the climate. Free trade agreements dole out favors to big farmers and big pharma. The financial crisis finished off what was left of monetarism, the idea that the Fed should worry only about inflation. And everyone has given up on waiting for low taxes to unleash the creativity of the ultra-rich. Under Bush, oil and gas, drug companies and defense contractors, insurers and usurers control the government of the United States, and it does what they want. This is the predator state. The wisdom of free markets? The president gave his own verdict in Houston the other day. Wall Street got drunk. True enough. But where were the grown-ups when the party went wild? For many years, liberals have lived in fear and thrall of the market mantra. It's time to get over it. For if true conservatives realize that our problem is a predator state, shouldn't liberals be out there doing something about it? Suddenly, planning, standards, regulation, and progressive taxes don't seem so bad.
James Galbraith teaches at the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. His new book is called The Predator State. Your thoughts are always welcome. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, scavenging for scrap in the recycling pile.
My real pet peeve is you'll see a nice piece of equipment, and you go to pick it up, and you find out that one of the scrap metalers has come by with a pair of pliers and just snipped the power cord off.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials plunged 1.9% today, 224 points, to finish at 11,431. The NASDAQ gave back just under 1%, 22 points, to close at 2355. The S&P 500 tumbled as well, 1.75%, 22 points, ended the day at 1266. Walmart unloaded 6.25% today after its same-store sales last month did not meet expectations. Target misfired by 4.75%. Teen apparel fave Abercrombie & Fitch staggered down more than 10% today. We told you that Citigroup would be forced to buy back $7 billion worth of auction-rate securities. Its stock suffered today a 6.25% loss on that news. Intel shares popped almost 4% today after a Citigroup analyst said the company's earnings guidance was more achievable. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.93%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. President Bush attends the opening ceremony for the Summer Olympics in Beijing. The Labor Department comes out with its second quarter productivity report. And on this day in 1908, Wilbur Wright makes his first public flight at a race course in Le Mans, France. The French are blown away by the spectacle. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick is trying to make some last-minute deals to save the Bay State's college loan program. Last week, the Massachusetts Educational Financing Authority announced that it, too, is a victim of the credit squeeze. So the governor is going hat in hand to find buyers for a state bond to keep those loans going out. Casey Ross had the story in today's Boston Globe. Casey, good to have you with us.
It's my pleasure.
How did the governor find himself in this situation of having to try to fund this bond?
Well, essentially because of the turmoil in the nation's credit markets right now and because of the unavailability of financing for the state student loan agency. The agency a week ago said that it would be unable to provide student loans for the upcoming school year, which is just a couple of weeks away, and so many bills are coming due. So it created a rather urgent situation, and the governor decided to step in.
And he has asked, you reported in the paper this morning, the state pension fund, and he's going to go talk to some local universities and colleges for money. What kind of reception is he going to get?
Well, right now it's a little bit iffy. The biggest request is of the state's pension fund, $50 million that he'd be requesting that the state's pension fund invest in the student loan organization's bond offering. And so far, the state treasurer has been lukewarm, if not, we're getting a sense that he's opposed to it at this point. When the governor comes in and begins dictating to the pension fund how it should invest, you know, that always creates a bit of a difficulty, a tension there. So that's still got to play out. As far as getting college endowments like Harvard, MIT, Boston College, and some of the other big ones around here, it's up in the air. The colleges are being very, very circumspect about it, so we don't have a lot of information about their willingness yet.
Time, as you mentioned, is running out. I bet those tuition bills are already on their way. Remind us how many students this affects and what Plan B is if this thing doesn't work out.
Well, it's about 40,000 students it would affect, primarily because if they're unable to access financing through the Massachusetts Educational Financing Authority, the student loan organization, then they would have to go out for Federal Plus loans potentially, which carry an 8.5% interest rate, which is higher than what the Educational Financing Authority here would provide. Or they would have to go out on the market, which can be very difficult because then you're talking about variable interest rates. Right now, that might be around 5%, but you know that could fluctuate pretty wildly over the course of the next several years and escalate their costs substantially.
Are there other states who find themselves in the same jam, and if so, what are they doing about it?
Many. It's a nationwide problem, and it's all driven by the bond market. People are not buying student loan bonds because they're backed by auction-rate securities. The market for that has completely dried up. So states across the country, more than 50 different student loan organizations have said that they're not able to provide federal or private loans this year, and a lot of them are trying to find out solutions to that. The bond offerings that have been going on so far have not been going very well. So I think it's a problem for which right now there's no solution.
Casey Ross is a business writer for the Boston Globe. Mr. Ross, thanks a lot for your time.
It's my pleasure.
Seven percent would be a pretty good return on your money, even when the markets are up. This year, it's just plain terrific. The Wall Street Journal reported this morning Harvard University made somewhere between 7% and 9% on its endowment during its most recent fiscal year. It leaves the school with $35 billion in the bank. Harvard didn't get flushed by being wasteful, but every year the university gives away warehouses full of used property, desks, cabinets, cubicle partitions, that kind of thing. And every week workers haul it all outside and let members of the public lug it away for free. Recently, the global economy has started to play a role in that giveaway. Hamad Ahmed reports.
I'm here in a parking lot behind Harvard University Recycling Center. It's Thursday morning, time for the weekly furniture giveaway, and the atmosphere is frenzied.
A couch! Oh my God!
There's a guy in overalls pulling PVC pipes out of a giant bin. A grandmotherly woman is hefting a laser printer into an office chair, and then she's pushing it along like it's a shopping cart. And all around me, there are men with hand trucks hauling away filing cabinet after filing cabinet. Off to one side, 8-year-old Gemma and her mother are holding hands as they look on. It's their first time here.
We just had heard about, you know, the free stuff, so we thought we would check it out, and it looks kind of like a zoo.
This is going crazy.
It is going crazy. Let's watch out so that we don't get run over.
I lose them in the crowd, but soon I'm talking to Sergio Lopez. He's one of the hand truck guys, and I ask him what he could possibly do with so many filing cabinets.
I come to pick up the metal,
I go get a little money, you know, for the metal.
We've seen an unprecedented level of people coming for the metal, just the metal value.
That's Rob Gogan. He's associate manager for recycling and waste at Harvard University, and he's been overseeing this event for years.
They pull out file cabinets, pipes and pumps, springs and sprockets, and even nails and screws.
Since January, the price of U.S. scrap steel has doubled from $350 per ton to $700. That's because in China, Russia, and Brazil, booming construction is fueling the demand for scrap steel at the same time as the U.S. dollar is depreciating. So now recyclers can make more money than ever selling scrap, which not everyone is happy about. Danny is a tinker and a craftsman who's looking through a bin of computer parts.
My real pet peeve is you'll see a nice piece of equipment, and you go to pick it up and you find out that one of the scrap metalers has come by with a pair of pliers and just snipped the power cord off. So it's now useless. It's now a piece of junk because they wanted the 5 cents worth of copper that was in the power cord.
Our intention and our hope is that our furniture will be recovered for maximum utility, for reuse.
Again, Rob Gogan.
Sometimes people say, well, you should give first preference to people who are going to reuse the furniture. And I would like to, but I don't have the staff to monitor and police who gets what.
The way Rob Gogan sees it, the furniture and office equipment may not always be reused the most efficiently, but at least it's not ending up in a landfill. Back at the parking lot, Gemma and her mother are walking by this dumpster that's overflowing with metal rods and rusty poles. I ask Gemma what she sees there.
A whole bunch of junk.
Yeah, so you think they might recycle it?
I think they might.
They'll make something out of it.
Like air conditioners or computers?
Like air conditioners, computers, or shiny new office buildings in Shanghai. In Boston, I'm Hamad Ahmed for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, I like to think I'm as up on Web 2.0 as the next guy. I've got a Facebook page. I'm toying with the idea of a blog. We'll see if that really works out or not. But I've never really understood what the big deal is about Twitter. That's the service that lets you microblog 140 characters or less, please, about what you're doing right now. And then all your friends and plenty of people you probably don't know can sign up to follow your every movement. Anyway, I don't know if this is a testament to how unhip I am or a sign that Twitter's best days are behind it, but I discovered today that the Securities and Exchange Commission Twitters too. If you don't believe me, we'll have the link on our website. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 224 points, 1.9%. The Nasdaq lost 22 points, just under 1%. The S&P 500 fell 22 points, 1.75%. Kevin Arnovitz, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, private equity pushes past the credit squeeze.
So the types of businesses that we're in, the amount of leverage we have, we're all done with the thought that the good times weren't going to last forever.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.